tonight on Arena. Richard Aldous on Lord Edward Fitzgerald and his friend Tony Small, and Justin Bieber and Lana Del Rey are among the albums up for review. You can text us on 51551 or tweet at RTE Arena. The late 1700s was a time of revolution. In America, the colonial states rose up against Great Britain. In France, the citizens stormed the Bastille and overthrew the monarchy. And in Ireland, a group of revolutionaries, the United Irishmen, inspired by the insurrections in America and France, planned a revolt against British occupation. A debut book by Laura McKenna, Words That Shape My Name, bring together these three major events in the person of two men, a former slave to an American plantation, Tony Small, and his friend, the Irish Lord Edward Fitzgerald. Richard Aldous has been reading it for us. Richard, the story of Tony Small has not only inspired Words That Shape My Name, but also a novel by Neil Jordan, which was also published this year, called Ballad of Lord Edward and Citizen Small. And given the historic background across two continents, not to mind slavery itself, it is a fascinating story.
Hello, Kay. Thanks for having me. Yes, I mean, it really is a fascinating story. It centres, as you say, around this character, Tony Small, who was an African-American slave who saved the life of Lord Edward Fitzgerald during the American War of Independence. He then returns with him to England and to Ireland as his personal manservant, and then travels with him to the West Indies, to France in the era of revolution, meets Tom Paine, and then is there in Ireland during the events leading up to the 1798 rebellion, and then flees afterwards and tries to sustain himself and his family, and gets into a kind of conflict with the Fitzgeralds. So it's a fascinating story, full of intrigue, and as you say, set in amidst all these fascinating historical events.
So we should begin really with, how did Tony Small meet Lord Edward Fitzgerald? It was some meeting, wasn't it?
It really was. I mean, it's one of those things where he's Lord Edward Fitzgerald is fighting during the American War of Independence. He's basically about to die. He's already been wounded, and Tony Small intervenes to save his life. And in doing so, he kind of forms this attachment with Lord Edward Fitzgerald, who, as I said earlier, then takes him on as his personal manservant. What is fascinating about this book, though, is that even as I recount that narrative, very cleverly, Laura McKenna is constantly complicating the story. So although we think that we know these events very well, she presents them in these multiple different ways. So actually, we're never entirely sure what has happened or what the relationship is and how things have developed between these two men.
Yes, because the title of the novel, Words That Shape My Name, is really a nod to the structure of the book, which is, well, definitely two testimonies, if not a third. Well, maybe the third is a critique. Will you tell us what the shape of the book is?
Yeah, it's, as you say, there are multiple narratives which are going on here. The book opens in 1857. The daughter of Tony Small is telling her story. So that's the first narrative. Then she is given, in this kind of what in film terms we'd call found footage, she's given something that has been written by her father, as when the Fitzgerald family had asked Tony Small to create a narrative primarily to try and help them get back his land and inheritance and so on. So you have that formal narrative. You then have Tony's alternate narrative, which really seems to be much closer to the reality of what he was feeling. And then the fourth narrative, which in many ways is actually the most sinister of the narratives, is Lady Lucy Fitzgerald, who was adding editorial comments to Tony's original narrative, trying to persuade him to change it so that Lord Edward Fitzgerald would be presented in a better light. So it's a fascinating structure, and these things bounce bounce back and forth off each other. And it does leave the reader, actually in a very pleasing way, slightly discombobulated, because just when you think that you know what's going on, Laura McKenna comes in and unsettles you again.
So Tony Small is asked by Lady Lucy to write the story in the form of a slave narrative. Now, people who've seen 12 Years a Slave might be familiar with that notion that so little of the slave history is known because so few of them were allowed to be educated so they could write their own narrative. But these became very popular. Was that because it was a time of the abolitionist movement?
Yeah, it's a number of things. That I mean, you do have these kind of famous narratives by people like Equiano, kind of, but also the woman poet, African American slave poet Phyllis Wheatley, who was a huge sensation in Britain in the 18th century. So yes, these narratives and kind of artwork by African Americans had been very popular, but what she really wanted. And what Laura McKenna plays with very cleverly really is this kind of old trope, racist trope of the kind of the so-called noble savage. And that bounces against another racist trope of the kind of the white savior. So she's playing with all of these kind of things. But exactly as you say, Lady Lucy Fitzgerald is really wanting to use Tony Small to present Lord Edward in the best possible light. And really, this is all rooted in inheritance, in money, in land, because those things had been confiscated by the attainder, which the Fitzgeralds had been subject to by the British government.
So what picture, untangling all those narratives, what picture of Tony Small comes across, and equally of Lord Edward Fitzgerald?
So he, first of all, Tony Small really is the heart and soul of this book. That he comes across as a man of great intelligence, of kind of great wit. He's also somebody who, as the book kind of goes along, he's constantly a kind of undermining the kind of the attempts by Lady Lucy to corrupt the narrative. So he really is the strong character. Lord Edward, actually, much to my surprise, comes across as a much weaker character, somebody who, yes, does have a genuine affection for Tony Small, but there's a kind of what today we would describe as entitlement about him, as he kind of uses his great privilege when he wants to use it, and at other times is kind of using this kind of very radical revolutionary rhetoric. And the tension between those two is actually unbearable. And one of the ways in which she illustrates that is really the bad way in which Tony is kind of subsequently treated by the Fitzgerald family. So it undermines this idea of the kind of the very noble image which is often held of Lord Edward and the Fitzgeralds more generally.
What insight, if any, do we get into the 98 rebellion, the plans for the rebellion, and Lord Edward's place in that?
Yeah, again, I mean, obviously, I'm not a historian of the 1798 rebellion, but I did have a sense of the drama. There's one particular, really, I think, very good scene where Lord Edward is making his way to Dublin, and he begins in these kind of great high spirits. He believes that the French are coming, that the rebellion is going to happen, that it's going to be incredibly successful. And as he travels to Dublin along the road, he keeps getting other bits of news. Hearing that the French have disappointed, that things are not going as planned, and so that really does actually capture this sense of the drama, almost kind of hour by hour, minute by minute, as these events are unfolding. So it's a very dramatically told story. I felt almost as if these events were happening in real time.
Yes, you get a real sense of the paranoia, the fear that there are spies everywhere.
Yeah, absolutely. That, and of course, you know, what's interesting about Lord Edward Fitzgerald, as we know, is that he comes from, in inverted commas, the other side, that he's a younger son of the Duke of Leinster. So kind of even that kind of adds to this kind of sense of complication in what's going on. Who's on whose side? Who is reporting back to the authorities and so on? So she really captures that sense of confusion, of drama, of the kind of the essential espionage of everything that's going on.
Yeah, the wealth of the Fitzgeralds is mind-boggling, isn't it? I mean, all the houses they own, which are such well-known landmarks for people here in Ireland, Carlton House, Frascati, then is Leinster House one of their homes as well?
Yes, that's right. So Leinster House, obviously, where the Doyle is now, was originally the house of the Duke of Leinster. He's the first Duke of Leinster, but it's a line that goes back a long way as the Earls of Kildare. So this is one of the oldest aristocratic families in Ireland. The Duke of Leinster is the kind of premier peer in Ireland. So, yes, I mean, you're right. She nicely captures this sense of luxury, but also the other side that after 1798, the kind of the sense that a lot of these things have been stripped away as Lord Edward has his property and his inheritance kind of confiscated, stripped away from him. There is a kind of a sense of desperation, particularly in the character of Lady Lucy, who's kind of trying to recover many of these things. And obviously, it's not even particularly about wealth. It's also about reputation, about status.
Now, they travel all over the world, really, after they met during the battle, during the American War of Independence. How is Tony perceived in Ireland and in the other countries they travel to?
So it's different in different places. So that, for example, when they're in the West Indies, I mean, he literally fears for his life because he's somebody who understands that his freedom as a manservant, his freedom could be snatched away from him. So there's a kind of a sense of fear around that. But then he kind of goes to France. And his experience there is very good. In Ireland, interestingly, and I'm not sure whether this is kind of just because of the novel, it's almost as if the kind of the race issue is not an issue, so that he doesn't seem in the kind of the accounts that are given in the novel to kind of go to be on the receiving end of very much in the way of kind of racism. Yes, he's kind of somebody who's different, and there are occasional references to the colour of his skin and so on. But he doesn't, perhaps because he's under the protection of Lord Edward Fitzgerald, that affords him a kind of a place in society as someone who's unusual, but who is spared the worst of the kind of racism that he might otherwise have expected.
Laura McKenna, the author, playing with the idea of the form of the slave narrative, did you feel in any way uncomfortable in reading, say, an Irish writer taking that form in writing a book about Tony Small, taking on his voice?
Yeah, there's no question about it, Kay, that, I mean, she skates on very thin ice here. This is very much a debate that is kind of going on now. For example, you know, we would not expect the Gate Theatre to put on a production of Othello with a white actor kind of using mm-hmm. blackface. So kind of somebody who is ventriloquizing, if you like, not just an African-American slave, but also that African-American slave's daughter. So there are two narratives here. You know, that's definitely skating on thin ice. She does do it with empathy, I think. The thing that struck me when I was reading it was that the fact that she plays with this, I think, and complicates this, that she's commenting on these things.
Yes.
For example, the fact of using Lady Lucy's editorializing kind of shows how these voices are taken by different traditions. So, you know, I think that the fact that she does it in this very self-aware, very complex kind of a way, I think means that it works. But there's no doubt about it that she has plunged herself right into the middle of one of the most controversial cultural debates which is going on right now.
Indeed she has. And overall, did it work for you, Richard?
It did work for me, I have to say. Not only did I enjoy it, but I thought the history was very good in America and France and Britain and in Ireland as well. And I liked the way that she played with these different narratives. And I was actually struck, Kay, that in many ways this is something that comes out of that Irish commemorative tradition that 1798, 1916 and so on, the way that they've been commemorated officially in Ireland is by recognizing all of the different traditions, the different narratives, complicating the story. And it seems to me that Words to Shape My Name is very much in that tradition and works very well in that way.
Well, Words That Shape My Name by Laura McKenna is published by New Ireland Books, and Richard Aldous, thank you very much. You're listening to Friday Night's Arena. Fiddle player Chris Stout is from the Shetland Islands in Scotland, where he was immersed in folk music from a young age. During the first lockdown last year, he composed a tune dedicated to a friend on his viola, an instrument he doesn't normally play. After a call from the RTÉ Concert Orchestra, he ended up performing it remotely with the orchestra, making it his first solo viola recording. I'm joined now by Chris Stout from Scotland to tell us more. Chris, you're very welcome.
Thank you. It's nice to be with you.
So had lockdowns something to do with the fact that you had only your viola to play?
I couldn't get my fiddles fixed. My fiddles were sitting on the wall. You know, I keep them on the wall hanging so they're always available to play. And there was what happens with fiddles, it's not uncommon. It's a bit annoying when it happens, but most fiddle players would agree. They can sometimes come apart. The glue can come apart, the seams, and they don't sound all that great. And it's just a regular bit of maintenance that needs to be done. And because we were in lockdown, I couldn't get my fiddles to the maker, who's a great friend of mine from Shetland, Ewan Thompson. But I was lamenting about this, but I had this viola, which Ewan also made, and I play it back and forth, but I'd never had an opportunity to really, really immerse myself in it. So I've been really getting into it, and I've been sort of speaking to players that I know from the orchestras here in Glasgow, getting them to give me tips and not just treat it like a big fiddle, you know. And I really, really enjoyed it. So
So were you a beginner with it, Chris?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I suppose I'm maybe an informed beginner, because I've obviously been playing the fiddle all my life. So
yeah, you know your way around it.
I know my way around it, of course. And I wouldn't just pick up a brand new instrument that I knew nothing about and have the audacity to assume myself a soloist with the RTÉ Orchestra. So, but I knew my way around it, yes.
So tell us about the piece you wrote then, The Generosity of Aird. Who is Aird and what makes him so generous?
He's a very generous man. He's a good friend of mine, Stuart. And I was deeply in debt to Stuart, because he was always giving me advice. And this kind of advice was invaluable, because in lockdown there was many practical DIY jobs to be done around the house that I'd never found the time to do. And Stuart's a joiner. He's a professional joiner. And whenever I needed to do something, I called on him, and he was always lending me tools. He was always on the end of a phone. He was just always there, and he helped me through so many situations that I would otherwise be completely hopeless.
But you wouldn't let him near the fiddles, obviously.
I wouldn't let him near the fiddle, no. I think he would agree. But I wrote him a tune, and in its first instance, it was just a small, humble jig, and that's where this piece, I suppose, grew from.
And then where were the orchestra ringing you to see had you anything in your repertoire that might work with the orchestra? Is that how that came about?
Yeah, sure. I got a call from Joe at the orchestra, and he just asked me that. He just said, "Is there anything you've got?" And I've been working on this thing, and I thought there is more in this, but I didn't. I knew that it could become something else, but I never considered that this sort of humble dedication, a humble thank you to my friend would become something symphonic. And I love it because I think that surely if anything deserves to become symphonic, then an act of generosity should. So I was kind of chuffed with that.
Well, let's listen to the opening section of that track now. This is The Generosity of Aird. Slow, broody jig there, transformed by the concert orchestra, The Generosity of Aird. That's Chris Stout's jig, and it's performed there by Chris on viola with the RT Concert Orchestra. So how was that created? How is it recorded? Where were you? Were you in Scotland?
Yeah, I was in Brazil at the time of the call, actually. And
this is the call with Joe Chibi, yes.
Of course, and I had a sort of a demo version of the tune myself, but when I got back to Glasgow, I recorded here. And the way it works is each individual member of the orchestra is recording their own part, which is absolutely incredible. I think it's such an amazing, ambitious but brilliant thing that the orchestra have done to get the players all recording and bring it all together and create a result, which is us all.
So you're recording your Chris. You're recording your individual part alone in your own wherever you have your instrument, and then you send this recording to Joe and the orchestra or the sound operator, who is Gardoffi, I think.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah.
And is there a conductor? No.
Everybody's a conductor. Everybody's their own conductor.
Right. But you're not given. Are you given? Did you give them ideas about tone or mood or tempo?
Of course.
Tempo?
You know, there's so much instructions. When you do it like this, there's so much has to be conveyed about how you want to play it and tempos and everything like that. Everybody has to follow a strict a guide of tempos, a guide tracks to play to, so that tuning works. And there's so much to do. I mean, it's an incredible thing for the orchestral players, especially, whose day to day job is essentially playing together on a stage in a rehearsal hall with 50 to 100 people. That level of communication is incredible, but to have that taken away and then suddenly they're the ones there going, right, the power of imagination, I'm going to have to play like I'm playing in a huge orchestra. And that's what these players gave to the project. And I think it's amazing.
Now, Chris, I know you're used to doing, orchestrating and working with orchestras with your work. But what was your reaction then when you heard the whole piece together?
It's, as I said, I think the whole thing's incredible. It's wonderful to hear your music brought alive by so many other players. There's once you hear an orchestra, it's impossible to unhear it. It's the most beautiful Indeed. Sound, I think. It's so emotive. It's powerful. It's a sound that everybody can relate to. It's on soundtracks. It's in the concert hall. It's, you know, it's on football games. It's everywhere. And it's such a privilege. It's such a privilege. And also knowing that how kind of attached the RTE orchestra, concert orchestra, are to your own tradition, and that thing that's going on, and the collaborations between traditional musicians and classical musicians, is a privilege to be part of, and it's fantastic.
Well, congratulations, Chris.
Thank you so much.
The generosity of Aird with Chris Stout and the RTE Concert Orchestra, mixed by our own Gar Duffy here, is available to listen to on rte.ie/culture. You're listening to Arena. Time now for album reviews. And first up, an album, number 7, from Los Angeles singer, songwriter and superstar Lana Del Rey. Her last album, Norman Effing Rockwell, was widely acclaimed. Her new album has an equally intriguing title. It's called Chemtrails Over the Country Club, and it's out today. Next up, Justice is the title of the new album from Canadian superstar Justin Bieber. It's the 27-year-old sixth album, continuing his journey from teen idol via R&B to an all-and-out pop again. And finally, from Belfast, the debut album from a punk band who have been getting praise on both sides of the Irish Sea. They're called New Pagans, and that debut is entitled The Seed, The Vessel, The Roots and All. Eamon Sweeney and Lauren Murphy have been listening, and let's start with Lana Del Rey. Chemtrails Over the Country Club is the new album, and this is the title track.
My sweet love, there's nothing wrong. Contemplating God under the chemtrails over the country club. Wearing our jewels in the swimming pool. Me and my sister just playing it cool under the chemtrails over the country club.
That was Lana Del Rey with the title track from her new album, Chemtrails Over the Country Club. It's album number 7 in the career of the 35-year-old, sometimes referred to as Miss America. Lauren Murphy and Eamon Sweeney are with me now. Her last album was entitled Norman Effing Rockwell. This one has an equally baffling title. Eamon, can you explain it?
It is an equally baffling title, all right. Not as profane, obviously. It's kind of really another kind of twist on her kind of version of Americana, and a more kind of like a minimal folk country thing, and just referring to the country club and kind of American wealth. But also having a look at American taboos. There's a very interesting track called Tulsa, Jesus Freak. And Dark But Just a Game, which is a track kind of about meeting an unnamed former hero of Lana's, and finding them to be really unpleasant. So we'll be speculating about who the identity of that is, I suppose, until her next album. But it's more of the same, but a lot more minimal. A lot more pared back than the Norman Rockwell record.
Lauren, you've used the phrase Hollywood sadcore to describe this music. Now she has that very lonesome voice. Is it the voice you're talking about, or the song's content?
Yeah, it's kind of a bit of both, I suppose. I know she's been labelled with that. I didn't coin that phrase as much as I would like to take credit for it, but she's been labelled with this Hollywood sadcore tagline over the course of her whole career, just because she does that sort of like breathy, seductive sort of singing voice, and her songs aren't generally hugely upbeat, I suppose. And she has this sort of glamorous Hollywood, it's both glamorous, I suppose, and she's going to the underbelly of Hollywood in some of her songs. I have to say that Lana Del Rey is someone whose music I've mostly admired rather than loved in the past. Something about just never really grabbed me. It always seemed very stylized and image conscious, but this album really pulled me in from the very first song. I think you have to be in the right mood for this kind of album, but if you are, it'll really capture you.
Yes, Eamon, lyrically, there's a lot going on here that I think you refer to there. They're extremely personal songs, like little vignettes recalling her youth and her past.
Yes, absolutely. Like she's become a very kind of interesting kind of a lyricist. And to be, you know, kind of like a song that kind of describing an affair with an alcoholic Bible basher. Is, you know, certainly not something you'd associate with someone who, you know, like is affectionately known as Miss America. And very interesting. Bruce Springsteen for the Norman Rockwell record, like he then acclaimed her as one of the greatest American contemporary singer-songwriters. And just at the closing, because as a parting glass too, we have kind of like a very good version of a Joni Mitchell song called For Free that features Wes Blood. He was emerged last year of like a psychedelic American folk artist. And that's kind of really fascinating because that song is about Joni Mitchell getting paid an absolute fortune to play a show. And she walks out and there's a busker across the street making nothing. So she kind of does the thing for free. So for somebody of kind of Lana's profile, but also kind of like giving props and bringing in kind of like an up-and-coming musician who is very promising as well, I think is very interesting.
Okay, let's listen to her version of Joni Mitchell's For Free.
Waiting for the walking green.
That's Lana Del Rey's take on Joni Mitchell's For Free from her album Chemtrails Over the Country Club. Lauren, you saw a lot of Joni Mitchell and people like Carole King in the songs of Lana Del Rey in this album.
Yeah, I think she does seem to be kind of not so subtly veering towards this Laurel Canyon 1970s sound. And you can hear it on even that song, obviously. But there's other songs, Wild at Heart and Let Me Love You Like a Woman and Dance Till We Die. And a lot of this album actually reminded me of Father John Misty's I Love You Honey Bear in many ways, which is an album I hold in very high esteem. So I know that Laurel Canyon sound has been done a million times by a new generation of artists, but she does it really well. Her voice is really suited to that era of music and her voice sounds brilliant throughout. Like, you can't fault her on that, definitely. She does that sultry, breathy thing so much better than so many of her peers, and it's easy to see why she's already spawned, you know, a generation of soundalikes at this point.
And has she have you bought her this time? You said that you admired her but couldn't say that you were totally into her in the past. Has this changed your mind?
It actually has, yeah. Even the last one, Norman Effin Rockwell album, it was, you know, I mean, it topped so many end of year lists that year, but I just didn't get it. But there's something about this album, maybe because it's a little bit more pared back and the arrangements are a little bit more simple, like Eamon said at start. It really grabbed me. You do have to be in the right mood, like I said, but I really enjoyed this album and I'll definitely be going back to it.
And Lauren, stars out of five for you?
I'll go 4 out of 5.
4 out of 5. And did it do it for you, Eamon?
It didn't. And it did to an extent. I do think she's done some great work over the years. Video Games, which is kind of like a breakthrough single, and her second album, Born to Die. I'd agree with Lauren about Norman Rockwell. Didn't really get the hype or drink the Kool-Aid about that. I think it's a strong album. I would go 3.5.
3.5. So 3.5 and 4 for Lana Del Rey's Chemtrails Over the Country Club. Next up at 27, he's been a household name for a decade. Justin Bieber, Canadian superstar, is back with his 6th album entitled Justice. Now, Lauren, the album opens up with a sample of Martin Luther King's speech, and then it goes into some tracks, and then we go back to another interlude of Martin Luther King, and the title of the album is Justice. Is this political or is it pop?
It's 100% pop. I don't know where he's going with the whole Martin Luther King thing. It seems very shoehorned into me, having listened to this album a few times. I mean, you know, like, it comes hot on the heels of his last album, which was released only last year. So it was clearly, it was made during lockdown. And he's given the whole promo spiel about this album being an album to, you know, unite people and act as a, basically a salve for this broken planet of ours. And he's not looking to solve injustice by making music, but we can all do our part, sort of thing. And it just kind of seems like a bit like Notions. I mean, he's a very rich pop star at the end of the day. So the Martin Luther King thing seems a bit like a hollow sentiment, because this is generally a record of love songs, mostly about his wife and his faith. So I don't get the justice theme really at all.
And he's in trouble for the word justice or the logo that he to show the title Justice. Eamon, what trouble has he got into?
Well, there's a very kind of, they've been quiet for quite some time, but a French electronic duo called Justice, and they have, they say that they're going to actually take legal action over the artwork. The T in the Justice title is like a cross, and the artwork is pretty much identical to their own logo. And they claim that Justin Bieber's representatives did contact them last year about kind of finding about image rights, and then just ceased contact, and then this just arrived, and it seems monumentally stupid, unless it's some kind of bizarre, expensive postmodern joke, and if really, as Lauren was saying there, that the whole concept of this album really seems muddled to the point of being completely pointless. To be honest, and this is now kind of on the day of release, the headlines are kind of are about his wife, but also about this kind of French duo who are basically threatening, saying that they're going to sue
fed up. Yeah, well, let's listen to a track from Justice by Justin Bieber. This is Die For You. Die For You from Justice, not Justice, by Justin Bieber. Eamon, you said there that, or I think it was Lauren was saying that it's 100% pop, because that is an issue with Justin Bieber, isn't it? He's passed two albums, I think, Changes and Purpose. He was saying that he was going down the R&B route, and he was unhappy when, I think it was the Grammys, put him in under pop. But this is very much a pop album.
Oh, very much so. Totally pop. I suppose the only thing it kind of maybe veers a bit more into would be kind of that American, very pop dancer known as EDM. And I suppose the cast list of Chance the Rapper, Khalid, Skrillex would kind of confirm that. But it's them at their poppiest. It's all very shiny. It's overproduced, very overpolished. And also, it just really, I'm speaking from experience of once having, you know, sitting through a show of his, and to all intents and purposes, it looked like he was miming through it. He does not have a good voice. It's completely over-treated.
I don't know. Off my face now, it's him and a guitar, and his voice, I think, sounds great. You beg to differ.
I'm afraid it doesn't do for me on any level. I don't really see those merits. I just find him also, you know, he's kind of like, you know, I know he's kind of supposed to grew up kind of like, you know, kind of under this microscope. Very bizarre behavior over the years. Very strange things. you know, someone, at least, you know, it's interesting, we've gone from Lana Del Rey, that I think is probably mainstream pop, sometimes at its best, to something that I think is mainstream pop really at its worst.
Lauren, he does address that kind of brat youth in the track Lonely, doesn't he?
Yeah, that's one of the few songs that's kind of the one of the more interesting ones, definitely, and definitely a more personal one. It's not just him singing about how much he loves his wife, kind of sees him more vulnerable, and he's basically singing about the price of fame and the silly things he did as a kid when nobody would essentially rein him in, I guess, and how, you know, ultimately fame and fortune is all irrelevant without someone to share it with. So, yeah, he does get personal to a certain extent. To me, a lot of these songs, both lyrically and musically, sound like, well, it sounds like he's attempting to be similar to an artist like The Weeknd, like this middle ground between R&B and pop that The Weeknd does so well, but he doesn't really pull it off, I don't think.
So stars out of five from you, Lauren?
I'll go 3 out of 5. I'm feeling generous.
Oh, 3 out of 5. And what about you, Eamon? I'm not expecting much.
0.
Are you serious?
It doesn't have any, I don't think it's any musical merit whatsoever. Just
well, I
not.
Guess you and Justice would agree on that. And finally, New Pagans, a 5-piece alternative post-punk band from Belfast formed in 2016. They have been getting some very positive press and airplay on both sides of the pond recently. And their debut album is out today. It's entitled The Seed, The Vessel, The Roots and All. And this is Bloody Soil. Soil from The Seed, The Vessel, The Roots and All from the band New Pagans. Eamon, tell us a little about this band.
Album, but some of the players like have been around for a while. So you know, there is a lot of different community experience there. Namely, Cathair O'Doherty was guitarist in a Northern Irish band called Jetplane Landing, who were really great, and Fighting With Wire. And very interesting mix of people, because you have a theatre director in there, and the singer Lindsay McDougall is an expert in Irish embroidery, and as a lyricist is what's interesting about Northern Irish pop music, it kind of seems to go kind of two ways. You kind of have the undertones in Ash, where it was certain about escapism and love affairs, or as the undertones really brilliantly put it, more songs about chocolate and girls. Then on the other kind of extreme, you had Stiff Little Fingers, That Petrol Emotion, Touts, and now New Pagans. Directly looking at Northern Irish society, all the problems and the baggage of identity, and you know, the stuff that annoys them about their homeland. And that's apparent in several tracks here, Christian Boys, Yellow Room, and so on. And it's a very, very fully realised, you know, really good, strong debut album. And I suppose it is because, you know, it's a new band, but an old band at the same time, if you like.
Yeah, Lauren, Eamon was saying there about Lindsay McDougall, who has researched historical stories and vignettes to explore issues such as mental health and female empowerment.
Mm. Yeah, there's definitely a thread of her. She's doing a PhD in women involved in textile art, like embroidery, I think. So that sounds like a strange inspirational touch point for an album and for a songwriter, but it definitely feeds into her songwriting. There's a song called Lily Yates, which is about W.B. Yeats' sister, who was a master embroiderer herself, and she established a printing press. And another song Eamon mentioned, Yellow Room, is inspired by a short story by Charlotte Perkins Gilman from 1892. So there's lots of stories of underestimated women here. And there's even, she gets personal in one song as well called Harbour, which was written about her pregnancy and has lines like, it's just you and me. So there is a lot of empowerment in general in the lyrics, which is great to hear and great to see you. Great to hear a woman talking about that sort of stuff, because, you know, often men aren't asked about those things in the same way. So she's taken control back, which is great.
Yes. And Eamon, a song called Christian Boys recalls one of the Lana Del Rey tracks, when it's a song about fundamentalist Christians and maybe involvement with them.
Yes, it's inspired by apparently a friend of McDougal's had an affair with a man who happened to be a Christian leader in Northern Ireland. And she says in the statement, it just made me so angry. He was in a position of power and she was very, very vulnerable young woman at the time. And that he took advantage of this situation. And then the whole classic trope, it all became her fault in the end. And she was the sinner. She was the one who had corrupted and taken this Christian, this great honourable man astray. And McDougal kind of reflects that basically that's a story that she's heard over and over and over again from so many different women in Northern Ireland in particular. And it's something that they've been scared to talk about. And she's kind of initiating a conversation with Christian boys.
Yeah, but it's imbued with this this punk energy then, the song, which makes it a real banger, doesn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. There's a great energy to this record. And, you know, it's exciting, it's entertaining. But then, as we've been discussing here, it's, you know, highly articulate record and an extremely interesting band, and it's an empowering listen. Like it's feel good guitar music, but dealing with some very dark themes.
Okay, briefly, Eamon, stars out of five.
Four out of five.
Four out of five, and Lauren.
Three out of five for me.
Three out of five and four out of five from the New Pagans, The Seed, The Vessel, The Roots and All. Lauren Murphy and Eamon Sweeney, thank you very much for reviewing the albums this week. That's it for this week from Arena. The show was researched by Liam Murphy and Paula Shields. Jamie Doyle was on sound. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. And tonight's show was produced by Sinead Egan.